We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. I'm joined by my co-host, Conrad.
Hello.
And in this episode, we are delighted to be joined by William Clouston, leader of the Social Democratic Party, also known as the SDP. Welcome to the podcast, William.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So the first question that I'd like to ask, because this podcast is looking at the Hartlepool by-election that's coming up, is have you decided who your candidate will be for Hartlepool yet? And if not, when will you be announcing your candidate and will you be selecting your candidate for that by-election?
Good question. Well, we're a democratic party. We have gone out to all the members. We do have a candidates list, but we've gone out to all members, and the head of candidates reported back on Friday with the shortlist. And as this is being recorded on Saturday, actually tomorrow on Sunday, the National Committee will select a candidate.
What makes you think the SDP has a great appeal in Hartlepool specifically?
I think our values basically sit on pretty much on top of red wall seats like Hartlepool. Our offer in politics, which is a blend of left and right, I suppose, pretty much reflects a lot of the ideas and concerns that voters have in red wall seats. So I think if you were to do a blind tasting, if people were to look at our policy platform and our attitudes and our beliefs and values, we would win the election. Because we're pretty much sitting on top of it. But that's possibly unlikely because we're a small party and growing. So we've always got a challenge of getting our ideas across. But certainly in terms of what we believe in, we don't have to move an inch. We are pretty much on top of what voters want in Hartlepool.
Now, of course, Hartlepool is an area that substantially voted to leave the European Union in the 2016 referendum. And of course, the SDP has supported Brexit for a while, a very long time. What do you think are the discernible differences Brexit has made already? Or do you think that these kind of differences are going to take longer to be seen in areas like Hartlepool and around the rest of the country?
I think you could argue that it changes the electoral dynamics, but a post-Brexit environment is different to a pre-Brexit environment, certainly in the general election in 2019. A lot of voters up and down the country were upset that their democratic vote in 2016 had been dishonoured, and, you know, this cultural establishment, media establishment, industrial establishment had tried to effectively to overturn that vote. And there was a lot of bitterness about it, and it needed resolving. And I think, yes, you could argue that 2019 resolved it. But of course, whenever there's a cultural divide and a value divide like that, these things tend to leave scars, don't they? So I don't think the political identity of being a Remainer or a Leaver just evaporates. It doesn't go overnight. And in any case, to a great extent, the value divides that those two labels represent are intact. To take David Goodhart's description, you might describe it as an anywhere, somewhere divide. But politics has certainly taken a cultural turn, and it has massive implications for the political parties, this. And I think they're still sort of grappling with the issues. I would say, yes, the sort of immediate, the acute intensity that you got in 2019 has probably faded somewhat. But the basic value divides remain, and I think the major parties are still going to struggle with that.
The major parties, Labour's held Hartlepool since it was created as a constituency. You describe your party as being left on economics. What specific policies do you think can appeal to these Labour voters?
The interesting thing about the SDP's offer, as I say, is it's sort of economic left-leaning and culturally traditional and patriotic, which, as I say, is a pretty good match for many, probably certainly a majority of voters in Hartlepool. What does it mean? I mean, basically, the important aspects of our economic ideas for Hartlepool are concerned with industry, industrial jobs. What we've had is 30 years, 40 years of econ liberalism, where we've been encouraged to be totally indifferent to what is made, where, and by whom. It's an ideology, basically, which, you know, post-Thatcher and during Thatcher's period was taken on pretty much by the establishment. New Labour took that view on as well. And so you've got, you know, basically 30, 40 years of deindustrialization. I think, you know, manufacturing industry now as a percentage of GDP is down at sort of 11%. And if you look at towns like Hartlepool, what's been undermined is the industrial wage, the industrial job, the secure industrial jobs has been undermined. So people, that's been replaced with precarious employment. And of course, behind every industrial job was a family that depended on that job. And so the consequences of both parties' indifference to industrial manufacturing has been very tough on Hartlepool and other places like it. So what we're seeing is basically the effects of economic liberalism gutting industry in the West, and the pandemic brutally brought that to the fore when throughout the West, it wasn't just this country, but the United States was exactly the same, you know, scrabbling around for kit because they've lost industrial capacity. They don't have the capacity to make their own essential strategic supplies. So basically our core message of believing in and wanting to reindustrialize comes with a whole set of industrial policies, which I can go into in more detail. But basically, neither Labour nor the Tories actually believe in these policies. So in terms of what they can offer Hartlepool, they don't offer much.
In terms of deindustrialisation, we've seen the impact not just on Hartlepool, but constituencies throughout the north of England of deindustrialisation. How would an SDP MP, if an SDP MP were elected, how would that MP advocate for more industrialisation or bringing industries back to Hartlepool? And how effective do you think one member of parliament could be in reinvigorating an area? Or do you think that they would just be a stepping stone for you to gain greater support in other parts of the country?
A good MP can advocate for the right policy, but I totally acknowledge unless you can change the core beliefs, the things that much of our political establishment have clung to for the past 30, 40 years, unless you can change that, then your macro policy won't change. So I totally acknowledge that. There's a limit to what an individual MP can do. Nevertheless, you make the argument. And actually, currently, I know, you know, a lot of our political opponents on the liberal economic side are slow learners, but just, you know, reality bites, doesn't it? You only have to look at the last 12 months to realise that actually some domestic resilience, some national resilience in a number of key industries is actually very sensible. And if you look at what, you know, contrary to their previous approach for the last 30 years, if you look at what the government's actually done, say, on vaccine production, they've taken a very domestic focus. I mean, we produce about 2 million vaccines under the, you know, the Astra jab is made here, about 2 million a week. There are plans to produce another vaccine in Stockton, which is very close to Hartlepool. Now, this is basically reality biting. People realise that, you know, global free trade was a rather utopian idea. And in any case, it simply hasn't been in the interests of core voters in places like Hartlepool. It's basically ripped their means of living away. And what have we been replaced with? Services and precarious jobs. So, no, you've got to make the case. But this is a parliamentary election. You want a, you know, good MP. I'm very excited about our shortlist of candidates. We've got some excellent people, and we've just got to do our best to get the message across, basically.
That point relating to the link between globalisation, in particular areas and constituencies, do you not also think that there will be people in Hartlepool whose jobs are linked to global industries and globalization, who may see the argument that you're putting forward as one that may hurt their jobs and may put them off voting for the SDP. What argument would you make to those voters?
I admit the argument that on the macro level, I mean, obviously, if you alter the terms of trade, there are winners and losers in that. I wouldn't deny that. And, you know, even the process of leaving the European Union and, you know, outside the transition area now, you only have to look at the changes to trade flows in the January figures to see there is, you know, there's considerable adaptation currently taking place. But what you've got to look at is in aggregate, are you basically raising the proportion of GDP which is proper manufacturing, or are you continuing to let it go? And at the heart of this is basically it gets back to a very simple word, indifference. What you've been encouraged to think, it doesn't matter where things are made. If you take that attitude and your industry literally migrates to the cheapest single factory producer, which is, you know, generally in Southeast Asia, generally in China, you literally end up with no industry at all in the end. I mean, that's the end game. Now, you can argue that in the short term, running colossal trade deficits, you know, even with the European Union, trade deficit is over 100, you know, about 80, 90 billion, getting on for 100 billion. You can argue in the short term, it doesn't really matter because you've got the goods. But remember, in trade policy, there's a basic arithmetic to that. You can only pay for your imports in three ways. You can pay them with what you make today. You can pay them with paper promises, i.e. debt, which is, you know, say a model like the domestic car sales industry in the UK is largely on that. We import German cars. We take on household debt for it. And the third way is to sell something which we've already made, which is passed off by successive Tory governments as FDI, you know, foreign direct investment. It's not investment at all. You're just selling what you already have. You're selling assets you've made in the past, usually property and other assets. So actually, if you're indifferent about these things, you will slowly become poorer. And that's basically what's happened. I wouldn't argue that an adaptation to a more industrialized society wouldn't be painful for some. But and also, incidentally, couldn't be pursued, it couldn't be achieved instantly. To get into this situation, we've had 30 years of indifference. To get out of it, you'd take 20 years, even if, as the SDP advocates, your major players in domestic policy, the Bank of England and Department of Industry and so on, were tasked with putting forward policies which were specifically aimed at increasing the proportion of industrial production from 11% up to say 15 or 20, and we're specifically tasked with reducing the trade deficit. It would take time. It really would take time, but it could happen. It does. You've only got to have the. Yeah, I mean, a point I would make to any Labour politician in this election is that Labour has been arguing for membership of the European Union strongly. I mean, Starmer strongly tried to dishonour this vote, and the candidate Paul Williams in this election also tried to dishonour people's votes in Hartlepool. Now, you can have that policy, but if you got what Labour wanted there, you couldn't have an independent trade policy. It's a fact. Now, if you can't have an independent trade policy, you can't reindustrialize. You can't reshore industrial production. You can't engage in industrial, an import substitution. So, and they profess, I mean, the Labour Party profess to be Keynesians, but their support, their continued support for the European Union would effectively prevent them from implementing the Keynesianism which they profess to believe in. So it basically their policy doesn't make sense. And on the other side, the Tory policy is continued indifference and in hoc to the city. So I think if Hartlepool voters are interested in a party that really believes in reindustrializing and thinks that the industrial job is important, they want to consider the SDP.
Now, you mentioned the Tory policy there, and the Tories have moved sort of somewhat economically left in the last few years with the like, you know, that's the sort of end of austerity era. And in terms of industrial strategy as well, they're considering nationalising Liberty Steel if it was to go under. What do you make of the argument that your voters and your sort of members could be better used to join the Conservatives and influence them towards the political ground that you want them to inhabit?
That's a good question. I mean, anyone, you know, choosing to promote and build up and rebuild a smaller political party must consider this. But you know, I was a social democrat, an active social democrat in the 80s, and I had 4 years in the Tory party. And I made friends, but I, you know, that was 4 years enough, to be honest. I think your prospect, your chances of getting the particular program, the particular combination, the sort of red and blue combination which the SDP represents within an organization like the Tories is next to, you know, zero, I would say, pretty much. I mean, the Tory party's strength is actually its sort of intellectual vacuity. I mean, it basically doesn't have any strong opinions. There are some liberals. I mean, there are some. Its biggest single group is probably, you know, Hayek type, you know, free trade liberals. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you can be a Gladstonian free trader, and if you are, you're better off in the Tory party. But the chance of the Tory party fully embracing, you know, trade friction and an active industrial policy. I mean, they just closed down the major committee on industrial strategy 2 weeks ago. I mean, they're not actually terribly interested in this. What you tend to get from the Tories is you know, fairly cheap announcements and PR. But I just genuinely don't believe that they are particularly interested in pursuing this. And likewise, it might seem bizarre, but on the socially conservative side, the SDP is a much more socially conservative party than the Conservatives, who are again some type of liberal party in effect. Or many of the difficulties they've got themselves into now with the overreach of woke progressivism, as a result of their own, I mean, they've been in government for 10 years, but most of the institutions have been overrun by this stuff, and they've done absolutely nothing to deal with it. And they, you know, it doesn't really matter which category you talk about. You could talk about, you know, ask yourself a question, have the Tories done anything to support the family? No, nothing, absolutely nothing. And they've had opportunities, but they're just simply not interested in it. And so if you want to pursue families that will support, you know, household formation and give citizens a chance to get a house and raise a family, the Tories are not the place you'd look, to be honest. So, no, I don't. It's a good question, but I think, honestly, anyone inside that has got to understand that, you know, if you believe in our sort of politics, you're probably wasting your time. You really are better off rolling your sleeves up and building your own organisation.
Looking at coronavirus, which has, of course, affected the entire UK, including Hartlepool, what lasting impact do you think it's going to have both on the general health of the population and the economy of the population? What impact do you think it will have on Hartlepool, and how would an SDP MP respond to that impact and seek to improve things for the constituents of Hartlepool?
Well, at the macro scale, the biggest impact will be even you know, not accounting for the local effects on local families and local individuals in Hartlepool. The macro effect will be simply the historic drag anchor effect of the colossal quantum of public debt which has been accumulated, and private debt. Although households actually the savings rates shot up from sort of 8% to 27%, so actually household savings in aggregate are rather good. You could argue that's possibly at the cost of, you know, extremely expensive furlough schemes and so on. But no, the you're looking at effectively a wartime type event here. And I'm afraid when you've got gaps in the PSBR, you know, the PSBR is absolutely colossal at the moment. I mean, you know, the Chancellor is going to really, really struggle over the next few years to pull that down to a reasonable effect. I mean, you can run a You know, you can run a fiscal deficit of something like 30 billion and the fiscal drag will look after it, and you know your debt to GDP ratio will not increase. But even we're a long way from that. I mean, I'm afraid the long-term effect for all of us is whether you call it austerity or whatever you call it, is just the reality of having to deal with a colossal quantum of accumulated debt. And, you know, the National Audit Office has kept running tallies of the aggregate cost of just government expenditure, leaving aside the corporate debt, which has been accumulated, just government debt. And it's running into the high 300 billion. So I suspect the aggregate total, once we've actually finally got out of it and things are back to what people might describe as normal, i.e., you know, the economy's open and most of the population is vaccinated, I think, you know, you're looking, if you combine it with private sector losses, you're looking at probably, a 1,000 billion. Which, as I say, that's the biggest effect of all.
A lot of people in northern areas such as Hartlepool feel a bit distant from Westminster. One of your policies is to create an English Parliament outside London, and to give it equal power to the Scottish Parliament. Yeah. You describe yourself as a unionist party. Do you not think that devolution, as it's been implemented so far, has just only seek to divide the union, especially given a platform for a party like the SNP and Plaid Cymru?
Oh, well, I think it has. Yes, no, I think there's no doubt about this. I mean, I'm on record as being extremely critical of the Blair government. The Blair government was given basically a golden economic legacy. The Major government was rather underrated government, actually. Clark as Chancellor did rather well in digging himself out of the recession. And they handed a legacy to the Labour Party, which the Labour Party promptly squandered. My criticism was literally all over their programme. They didn't do any proper socialism. They didn't look at nationalising the utilities, which had been rather sensible. They didn't nationalise the railways, didn't build any council houses. They did nothing, absolutely nothing, on the econ left side, things that we would be interested in doing. They had every opportunity to do so. They didn't believe in it. And they lost confidence in arguing for it. So they were useless at that. But and then, you know, obviously the main scar of that government was the very foolish involvement in the Iraq war and attempting to impose liberalism into complex Middle Eastern societies that had no real interest in it, at the cost of 650,000 lives. So shocking on that. But the question is about devolution. That's another thing that Blair got wrong. Blair thought that the upswing, the interest in Scottish nationalism would be quelled. He thought it would be reduced and assuaged, basically, by creating a Scottish Parliament. I don't think the Welsh were particularly interested in it. I think the euphoria of Blair and the Labour influence in Wales took it over the line, and you know, it was only just taken over the line by a few votes in Wales. But in Scotland's case, he basically fed the tiger. I mean, he fed something which they couldn't control. It was Donald Dewar said that, you know, Scottish Parliament would kill the demand for Scottish independence dead. Well, it didn't. It just fed it. And so just on a very basic question, I mean, any entity, it's a bit like biological entropy. You know, something's either declining or getting bigger, and an entity like the United Kingdom is either disintegrating or integrating, and Blair basically through devolution set it on a path of disintegration. Now, where we are now constitutionally, there is very little appetite to remove the Scottish Parliament in Scotland, and if anything, we've just got a battle on our hands to keep Scotland in the Union. So what we haven't addressed is the English question. And I think a sense of Englishness and English identity has been put on the table, really, by the Celtic nationalism that we find in Scotland and Wales. And I think you can't ignore that. It's not just technical questions like English votes and English laws or the West Lothian question. Those are difficulties, but I think the bigger question is you can't leave England out of this. And so we deal with it as a party head on and say, well, if we're going to have a Scottish Parliament and a Welsh Assembly and so on. You need an English Parliament to convene English identity and English policy. So that's what the proposal is. And then the cost of that, because you can't have parliaments all over the place, is to have a unicameral UK Parliament, which I think would make sense because, after all, the UK competences would be basically foreign affairs and defence and the things that span all four countries. So I think it would work. My preference would be for a parliament in York, although we don't actually say that. The SDP's policy board didn't agree with my suggesting York, but I think York's a place where it, historically, culturally, it should be. And I think it would work well. I think the main criticism I hear against an English parliament is that it's, you know, people say, well, it's England's too big and it would dominate. Well, that actually doesn't follow. And the people that say that haven't actually thought very carefully about it, because if you think that you can't have an English parliament because it's too big, well, then you can't have a union of England and Scotland and Wales because England is still too big. So I'm afraid the you know, if you have a United Kingdom which is composed of different sized countries, it follows that if you have, you know, parliaments underneath that in a federal system, they would also be bigger or smaller. What I don't like is a sort of anti-English tendency, which you got in the Labour Party, to try and split England into little regions. And we had a look at that in the region that I live in the Northeast, and we rejected it totally. We don't want England to be split up into little regions. I think the people that argue that just aren't very comfortable with Englishness.
In regards to the idea of a devolved English Parliament, how much support do you think that actually has in terms of the wider population?
I think it's changing. I think English people were quite ambivalent to it, and I think, you know, for a long, long time, the tendency was for English people to basically view their identity as synonymous with Britishness. So, I mean, this has been going on a long time, and they didn't really need to. I mean, if you're the largest component in a multinational state like this, it really wasn't very important. I think interestingly, I mean, if you look at the after I was born in 1966, when England won the World Cup, it was largely Union flags that were being waved around at Wembley. And as I say, the English people thought of the Union flag as theirs, almost synonymous with the English flag. But I think that's changed. It's one of these cultural turns which over, you know, 20, 30, 40 years has changed. So I think in a way the Celtic nationalism has woken up English nationalism and the sense of English identity, which is, put it this way, in terms of a direction, I think a sort of enlightenment of Englishness is the direction we're going in. And I see no reason why we shouldn't take it to its logical conclusion and have a parliament.
Now, your party is seen to be sort of culturally and socially right-wing. Now, what is your policy on sort of the hot button, sort of traditional, I guess, the issues that have always sort of dominated social conservatism on gay marriage and abortion?
Good question. I just want to slightly challenge you there. I mean, I suppose even occasionally we use that as a sort of shorthand to say, you know, left on econ and right on culture. But I simply don't accept that. I mean, I think, if you look at the history of, the SDP is an offshoot of the Labour Party, and if you look at Labour's history intellectually, if you look at figures like Attlee and Gaitskell and Peter Shaw, you will find, you know, social conservatism. I mean, the idea that you could do what you liked, the individualism that we're faced with now, people on the left were constantly argued against that. Also constantly argued in favour of the family. So you could say it's on the right, and I concede it that people say that, but I personally don't, particularly in relation to red wall seats, actually. And, you know, if you look at the region that I live in Northumberland and Durham, the traditional Labour voter is socially conservative. So it's whether you say it's on the right or left is a little bit debatable. So on gay marriage, yeah, I mean, we are socially conservative, but we're not in denial of the what you might call the sort of great liberalisation since the 60s. There's no going back. I mean, people, you know, we support gay marriage, and the SDP actually in the 80s was at the forefront of promoting gay rights, And I see no problem with that at all. The definition of the family that we use is pretty broad. What we do is defend, two parents being present to raise kids. Takes two to make them, takes two to bring them up. That's an ideal. It's not to say that it always works out like that. It's certainly not to say that someone in a desperate and happy marriage or an abusive relationship should put up with that. And often it doesn't work out. And so you're always going to have, people raising kids on their own, and that's very tough. But as an ideal, and for society, the data is in. I mean, there's no question that, stable two-parent families produce better outcomes for children and therefore for society. On the question of abortion, we're not going to have a party policy on this. And I think we're probably right to avoid that. I don't think any major political party does. Possibly some smaller parties do, but we won't be doing that. I think my personal position is that I think the term limits presently on abortion are probably too long, and I would probably reduce those. I think ethically, it's very difficult to make a case for, a thought experiment, a hospital, where a premature baby of 20 weeks, whatever, is being kept alive, and in the same hospital, a baby for that term is being aborted. I think that's a very difficult question. I also think there's probably more evidence now on the viability on that question as well. But I'm not against abortion personally, in principle.
We're coming to the end of the podcast, and it's been great to speak to you, William. And I have one final question. A collection of 300 historical swords, including a sword that is believed to have been given to Lord Nelson by his uncle, is at the moment being looked at by Hartlepool Borough Council to be bought and displayed in Hartlepool. So my final question to you is this: what do you think of that move, and how do you consider Lord Nelson in the context of historical British figures?
Well, I think that you open up abroad. I mean, of course, a major historical figure, and along with his contemporary Collingwood, who is a massive local hero in Newcastle. You know, and there's a very fine plaque in Newcastle Cathedral on Collingwood. I think generally we've the move to I think the English have always been a little bit ignorant, actually, in history. It's not just, you can blame progressives for sort of wanting to decolonize and to denigrate British history and imperial history. You can do that, but the broader problem has, for many, many years, has been just a lack of interest, a slight indifference to our own history. So no, I'd support that. I think any attempt to reconnect us with our past is a very positive thing. And as a culturally traditional party, we'd support that 100%.
Thank you for coming on the podcast, William. If people want to find out more about the SDP or yourself, where should they go to find out more about you and your party?
Well, the best place is the main website, which is sdp.org.uk. And on there, you'll find obviously our policies and details of the party, and also something called SDP Talk, which is a series of articles and also filmed interviews with various political figures, including people like Peter Hitchens and Calvin Robinson and various others, Claire Fox. So have a look at that, and we're on Twitter as well. You'll find us, and check us out.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. Great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.